The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week, and are we lucky to have her, is New York State Senator Liz Krueger, a Democrat serving New York's 28th District on the east side of Manhattan, and the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, which gives her a lot of power and a lot of insight. Welcome back, Senator Krueger.
Thank you. I do think it gives me insight. I'm waiting to see where that power might be, but thank you for saying that.
Were you in the contention to be Vice President of the United States?
Not beyond a handful of people who have written me suggesting that that wouldn't have been a bad idea, which makes me laugh. So that's okay. As I've been saying forever, whomever my party nominates for this election, including small animals, I will be fighting to the death to make them the president and vice president next term.
Well, Liz Krueger, let's talk about that a little bit. Was it a good choice?
I think it actually was a good choice. You know, neither was my dream ticket, but I've never been right about who sells in the national framework for a presidency. You know, we tend to be more liberal than many parts of the country, even within the Democratic Party. And so the fact that Biden is a well-known choice who does seem to get enormous support across fairly broad range of Americans, including people who don't identify as registered Democrats, I think is a huge advantage walking into this election. The fact that you can't say he hasn't seen it and done it all by now. I do think it was very important for the ticket to be balanced with a person of color and a woman. And Kamala Harris had gained a huge amount of attention and support outside of California through her presidential campaign. So I do think there is an argument for the vetting process of a presidential campaign for evaluating both the president and a vice president on a ticket. So I think lots of boxes are checked that I think are very helpful for walking into the election.
So now you said you were talking about a dream ticket. We knew Biden was going to be the presidential candidate. Who was your dream vice presidential candidate? I'll bet I know, but you tell me.
Well, so to go a step backwards, during the race for the presidency, I was an Elizabeth Warren endorsee.
I would have won my bet.
Pardon me?
I said I would have won my bet. I said I would bet I know.
I'm sort of obvious that way. So I just found her mix of intelligence and progressive policy and big picture changes something I could identify with so much. I don't quite understand why this country seems to have so much trouble imagining a woman for president. I have no trouble imagining a woman for president. So, yes, yeah, so she was an obvious for me. As the candidate, you know, names were running through over the last few months for vice president, I kept watching someone that, yes, she's not been an elected official, but I think a lot of Americans had gotten to know, which was Stacey Abrams. I think she has an extraordinary future ahead of her. And I thought she could be a very attractive VP candidate with Joe Biden. I don't think I ever quite stretched to the idea of a Warren Abrams ticket, because I just felt in my heart, if I wasn't sure this country was ready for a woman president, I certainly wasn't going to propose a two-woman group for president and vice president. But once Biden had the nomination sewn up, you know, I must admit, I thought Stacey Abrams was a really interesting combination mix with him. I have to say, I never followed Kamala Harris that closely on her campaign, just because I had so early jumped to Elizabeth Warren. So I'm open, and I probably won't like everything she stands for the same way I don't like everything Biden stands for. But it's those issues are so minimal to me compared to the fundamental question. Are we going to make sure that Donald Trump does not stay in the White House? Because I believe that will be the end of the United States of America. I do not think we can survive a second term of a white supremacist fascist who has absolutely no interest or respect for the Constitution remaining the president of our country. So, you know, there's almost no room to even care whether I have specific problems right now with anyone on my ticket.
Okay, Liz Krueger, let me ask you this. You are obviously a progressive, somebody who has wide-ranging ideas about equality and things that ought to be done in this country. And yet, we are hearing from some of, albeit a better name for it, is the Bernieites, people of the left, who say that they may want to sit on their hands or they may not want to vote in this election. I'm troubled by it. Are you?
Yes. I don't even understand the concept. You know, maybe you're very young, so you have no historical knowledge at all, but you really only have to remember Obama to Trump. You don't have to be that old to realize that the sentence, it doesn't really matter who the president is, pox on all parties and all their houses. Really, is there anyone left in this country who still thinks that if they don't get their perfect candidate, they'll hold their breath till they turn blue? And after all, what will it really matter anyway? There's no difference between the leading contenders in the two major parties. It's like, I'm not a violent person. You know that, Alan. I just want to slap some people, right? I just want to slap them. So like, I'm sorry. Did you, like, leave the planet for the last 3.5 years? So not only do I not understand that, but I fully expect, you know, Bernie and anyone else who had hoped to be president but didn't get it to stand up and say, okay, I wish I was the candidate. I'm not, but this is life and death time, people, so get over yourself.
And Bernie has
my
said that.
Yes, good. So let him keep saying it and let his, you know, supporters hear it loud and clear. So There's no excuse.
Liz Krueger, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee and a person with incredible knowledge of the way things work, I want to ask you this. The primary, what do you make of Elliot Engel losing, the progressive gains, Carolyn Maloney almost losing, and absentee ballot counting and voting this November?
Well, I'll take the second one first because I sat through an all-day hearing on our election. It was a joint legislative hearing of the Assembly and the Senate with testimony both from reps of state board of elections, city board of elections, individual county boards, advocacy groups for good government and democracy. And I had been, even before yesterday, quite involved in criticizing how poorly the city board of election handles preparation for the primary day, and counting of ballots after primary day. It's actually embarrassing how badly New York is at conducting elections. It's also true that we had many antiquated election laws that tied the hands of the Board of Elections that the legislature has now passed bills to fix. We got to the party late, and we only passed those bills 3 weeks ago when we're up in Albany. But there's a package of them sitting on the governor's desk, passed by both houses. It is crucial that the governor sign those as quickly as possible, because even as late as yesterday, Board of Election officials were saying, we plan for elections based on what the law is. So those things aren't law yet, so we're not planning for them. Wrong answer. They have to be in prep for November right now. They have to be prepping under the laws we've passed but need signed by the governor. And here's the biggest example for you. Because of how they read law, they didn't start to process the requests for absentee ballots or mail out the absentee ballot applications until way too late. Then they cut very, very short the time they had to send out the actual ballots. In New York City, the numbers are a little iffy, but I'm pretty comfortable with this one. In New York City, 75,000 of those paper absentee ballots never even hit the U.S. Post Office to get to people's homes until 2 days before the election. Who thinks they could get to someone's home, be filled out, and be successfully mailed back and meet the timeline under law of when ballots have to come back? As a result, something like 21 to 25% of paper ballots were ruled not legally able to be opened and counted for this election. 25% of the absentee ballots were not able to be opened and counted. And a huge percentage of New Yorkers chose absentee ballots because of the pandemic and their fear of walking into a polling site with too many people and too little protection. So, hello, it's not brain surgery to understand the Board of Elections have to start this earlier, get it out earlier, and get the ballots back earlier. We did make changes in the law. We need the governor to sign them.
Do you think that there's any risk that the governor doesn't really want this? I mean, you know, it would seem like a slam dunk that he would just sign them and get rid of them. You know, you think that he may not really want absentee balloting?
Alan, I don't know how many times I've been on your show over the years, and I think in each show you have said you thank the governor. And I swear, if you go back and look, every single time I have said to you, I would never presume to understand what the governor's thinking or to presume what he might actually do. I will say today, as of August 12th, I am urging every New Yorker to contact the governor and say, please, governor, you need to sign these bills that the legislature has handed you. It's an emergency. Now, the other part of your question was, what's the lesson learned from the fact that you had a well-established congressperson from the Bronx who did lose their election? You had my congresswoman, Carolyn Maloney, come closer than any of us expected, but I think the final numbers show her with far less than the sliver imagined of her win. But it does raise the question, are there new generations of voters who have different expectations of their candidates? And I think the answer is yes. And even though it means longer-term incumbents like myself might very well be a greater threat in our elections, I think it's healthy for democracy. I have never, ever shied away from supporting the right to primary within a party. And if you're in New York City, there's not that many Republicans left. So the real action is in a primary. Speaking for myself, if the voters say, we're done, Liz, you've been there too long, or we don't think you meet our expectations, or we're not as comfortable with you as the person running against you, then it will be time for me to leave office. And I personally think that will be fine. I think there is a stronger, louder, younger wing of the Democratic Party that is growing in strength, certainly in my city, that identifies far more with what you would define as the, you know, Bernie Sanders part of the Democratic Party, the DSA part of the Democratic Party. Even when you introduced me as a longtime progressive, I've been joking lately that I'm starting to feel a little bit like the right-wing part of the Democratic Party in comparison to some of my newer and now expected even newer colleagues coming on board in January because they did win their primaries. I think it's healthy for democracy. I sort of love it when I'm in a room with my young, incredibly hungry, incredibly smart new colleagues who really want change, don't understand why it takes so long, and challenge my assumptions too. And we have some fights, but I love them because they're substantive policy fights. And I don't know, that was always my fantasy of how democracy actually was supposed to work. So I may not sound like some kind of party loyalist, and I like Elliot Engel and respected his voting history, and others who may likely not be coming back soon in the assembly. We lost some excellent assembly members. It doesn't mean I'm not going to love their replacements. And I do think this is what democracy is supposed to look like.
Just for the sake of it, because I think some people heard you, Liz Krueger, and didn't quite get it. There's a bunch of bills on the governor's desk which would reform the way we vote in New York. Could you give us a little primer on that, just what they are?
Okay. So one of them is called the Authorizes Absentee Voting Due to Risk of Contacting or Spreading Disease. So really under New York state law, you couldn't use we're living in a pandemic to be the basis to have the right to an absentee ballot. The governor, through executive order, had allowed it for the June primary, and everybody hoped nobody would sue over it. But we all agreed you really needed a law allowing this. So that's what we had done, a law allowing a broadening of the definition of when you can use an absentee ballot to include the risk of contracting or spreading a disease that may cause illness is the basis for somebody being allowed to use an absentee ballot. See, in New York State, we would need a constitutional amendment to just go to a mail-in system that doesn't require any reason to be absentee. And as you know, a constitutional amendment process is quite long. We're not going to get that done by November. So there are many people urging constitutional amendment. I share their view, but it wasn't going to solve the problem for this coming election. So we need the bill to allow that. Then we have another notice and opportunity to cure absentee ballot deficiencies. Absentee ballots create a whole new list of things where the voter might accidentally make a mistake, which would result in their ballot being ruled invalid. So it's things like you forgot to sign the back of the inner envelope when you put it in the outer envelope to mail back. You might have stray marks, or you might have thought you were supposed to write something on it instead of just checking a box about illness. You might have written, this is because of COVID concerns. Well, you just meant it to be clarifying, this is why I'm using an absentee ballot, but since you wrote something on it, that invalidates the ballot being counted. So this bill would make it clear that Board of Elections had much larger discretion to count your ballot, even though something was slightly off, but nothing that didn't make clear this is who you are and that you wanted to vote this way and this was your actual vote. Then this whole new issue for us, counting ballots without postmarks. The law has always said when you're returning a ballot by mail, proof that it came through the mail and got to the Board of Election in time was the postmark on the outside of the envelope. Well, this year we learned that the U.S. Postal Service, for several reasons, wasn't postmarking these envelopes. We had made the envelope self-stamped. You know, you don't have to put a stamp on it. It gets paid for by the board if you return it. Lots of mail goes that way. Well, it turns out the U.S. Postal Service decided they don't postmark those kinds of envelopes anymore. Wow. And in many cases, the postmarks that they do put on, they're 100-year-old machines. They haven't cleaned the ink cartridge forever. So all you get is an ink blob, not something that says postmarked at X date.
And that disqualifies the vote?
That disqualifies the ballot from being counted.
Wow.
And huge numbers were based on that this year, were thrown out. So we want to make it clear that even if there's not a postmark or it can't be read correctly, the Board of Election can still count these absentee ballots as long as they arrive to the Board of Election on the day of the election or after the election, unless there's evidence that a real postmark makes it later than that. So that should also just be a huge difference. And the last is allow earlier applications for absentee ballots. As I said before, we didn't let the Board of Election start soon enough. So all the requests for absentee were piling up. Then they all had to be rushed at the same time out. They didn't have enough staff to handle that. Then they had to rush to open the request for the absentee and process for the ballots themselves, which they also ended up waiting way, way, way too long for in certain parts of the state, Manhattan being infamous now, where I come from. And so we are just setting a much longer time frame in which Board of Elections, wherever you live in New York State, could send you the request for absentee ballot, process the request, and send you the actual ballot with more than enough time, even with slow postal service, for you to get it, fill it out, and send it back such that it's at the Board of Election, legally ready to be counted after the election.
Okay, now, Liz Krueger, I get it. And I appreciate that very much, because a lot of people wouldn't have known unless you told them. But I do want to ask you about the state's coffers. Right now, we have at least a $30 billion deficit over the next 2 years, according to the governor. And you're chair of the Finance Committee. But what can you tell us about the state's finances?
We're really in trouble. And there's a lot of different reasons for it. But the biggest one is that because of the pandemic triggering at the same time, a world economic meltdown. And I don't quite understand how it triggered that all so quickly at the same time. But apparently it did, because here we are. So massive numbers of people became unemployed. Businesses couldn't open or remain open. They stopped paying their taxes. Their workers weren't workers, so they weren't earning anything, and they stopped paying their taxes. Our revenue situation, in my opinion, was already too shaky because the governor had not been open to new revenue proposals even before this crash. We did not have a large enough rainy day fund, in my opinion. We did not watch carefully enough over commitments of money by the state compared to monies that were actually going to be available. I personally believe the governor played a little too fast and loose with, if he had a cash management plan that was able to keep paying out on bills, he could overcommit on the actual money we had and stretch it out. And Rob Mojica's, his budget director, is actually very good at dancing around. If the numbers don't add up, still get it to happen. I think it's a mistake as a model for state finances, but I will say the Cuomo administration has been skilled at that, except that means when suddenly the bottom falls out, it really falls out and you've overcommitted.
Liz, give us an example of overspending. Where were we not careful enough about what we were spending?
So the governor's commitments on massive capital projects and massive promises through his economic development programs to exempt people's obligation to pay taxes through expenditures and credit and just fronting out the money. I mean, there are stories of the state of New York pouring money into an economic development project, hundreds of millions of dollars. The deal goes down the tubes. The state can't get the money back. They're sitting there with an empty building they've built. Suddenly they're making a second deal for another multiple hundreds of million dollars on the same site. That one falls apart. They're looking for a third partner. What are we doing? I don't believe very strongly, I don't believe we should use taxpayers' dollars and act like we are hedge fund investors. We shouldn't be in the investment business and picking winners and losers through our tax policies. We should have the most even playing field for everybody under our tax policies. We shouldn't try to pick winners or losers. We shouldn't try to do a special deal.
Okay, Liz, so we don't have enough money. The governor says 14 to 16 billion this year, same thing next year in the hole. Some people in the legislature say tax the rich. Should we?
Yes, I actually do support progressive taxation. Those who are being more successful and earning more, even in this economy, should pay their fair share. And under our current tax policies, and you know this, sometimes somebody who's barely holding on is paying a higher tax rate than a billionaire because they have opportunities to define their earnings as not counting for tax purposes. So I am a big believer in a fair and progressive tax system, and there are many ways for New York State to make changes in our tax policies that do make it fairer and also bring in more revenue. And yes, the likely payers of that increased revenue are the people on the highest income scales and the corporations on the highest income scales. But, you know, even during this pandemic in the last 6 months, some of the largest companies in the world, many of whom have major roles here in New York, have had the best time of their history. Billionaires have multiplied their money at an incredibly rapid rate during the 6 months of economic downturn pandemic. With all due respect, if you made a couple of extra billion January to August, I think you can kick in a slightly higher tax contribution to the state of New York, and you won't even notice it.
Liz Krueger, very quickly, because we only have 1 minute, so it basically takes a yes or a no. We're going to send kids back to school in New York. Good idea or not?
Oh, God. Hardest question I get every day, Alan. I tell parents you have to do what you believe is right for your kids. There is no good answer here. There really is not. There are risks if you send their kids back, but there are also risks when you leave them home, when you have to go to work and have no place for them to be, or if you're sure that your kids are really not learning through the online system. I would argue if you have young kids, they're not really going to miss out on the education. They'll catch up, and they can't learn by computer anyway. They're too young. So if those are the kids you have and you can keep them home, I'm going to argue for you to try to keep them home rather than putting them at the risk of the classroom. And it's not just the risk of the kids. As we know more and more, the kids are carriers of the germ.
Yep.
That they may not ever have a symptomatic case, although some of them do. But then they come home where maybe it's a three-generation household now because lots of people have had their elderly parents move in with them, which I totally understand their need to do that. So even if your five-year-old is going to come back from kindergarten without ever feeling sick, if she's a super carrier and she's walking back into your house, grandma is at serious risk. Her parents might be at serious risk.
Sure.
So I would think long and hard before I sent my young child back. And I believe, as New York City is doing, and I think most of the state is doing, we need to give parents the right to make the decision for themselves and their children that they believe is the right answer. We cannot mandate this on them.
We're out of time. Our guest has been New York State Senator Liz Krueger, an amazing, amazing legislator. Liz, thanks so much for joining us.
Take care.